I'm Artie Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. It's tough to have a civil discourse with someone we disagree with, and it seems like there are a lot of things to argue about these days. A year of one crisis after another, and now a highly partisan and divisive campaign season, have forced most of us into like-minded camps or tribes, gravitating to people who share our same beliefs. But seeing another person as the other, or even as the enemy, comes with a price. So today on Radio Times, civil dialogue, how to talk to a person you disagree with, how to have a meaningful conversation to understand their point of view and to feel heard yourself. Joining us is Lucas Johnson. He is Executive Director of Civil Conversations and Social Healing for the On Being podcast with Krista Tippett. On Being has an ongoing series of civil dialogue guidance, and he's been doing this facilitation work for a long time. Joining us from Amsterdam, one of my favorite cities. Lucas Johnson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us is Abby Stammelman-Hockey. She's Executive Director of Interfaith Philadelphia, and they did a year-long project of civil conversation facilitation in collaboration with On Being's Civil Dialogue Project, and she joins us by Skype. And Abby Stammelman-Hockey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. And I should say to our listeners, we tweeted out a series of questions during the week, which I will read with responses to them during the hour. You can always join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Lucas Johnson, let me begin with you. And I referenced our year of crisis, and it's not over yet. I think most people are on edge, feel as if the future of the country, if not the world, is at stake. Are we in the right frame of mind to have civil discourse with people we disagree with?
Well, I mean, I would say, Marty, that we're probably not in the best frame of mind, but I don't think that we have a choice, really. I think we have to, you know, we have to engage with where we are, and I think that the important thing to do is to prepare ourselves for that engagement.
Well, and to you, Abby Stammelman-Hockey, I do think, while on the other hand, on the one hand, there is a lot of partisan and intense disagreement about a whole host of issues, there is a hunger for connection as well. I think you can really feel that, too.
Yes. What we have found is the vast majority of people really want to connect with people in their families, in their workplaces, in their neighborhoods, in their congregations. And there's a real yearning to be understood and to understand one another and to find a way to have meaningful conversation.
You know, I'm thinking, I'm actually watching the service for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And Lucas, I'll put this to you, but Abby as well. And we have learned and we knew over the years that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Justice Antonin Scalia, who probably disagreed about almost everything related to our legal system, the Constitution. If you read some of their dissents and their opinions, you can see they viewed the Constitution very differently. But they had a shared love of opera and they really enjoyed each other's company. I wonder, Lucas, if there's something we can learn from Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Antonin Scalia.
I think there certainly is. I think that, you know, they both loved opera, but they also had a deep passion for, I think, the country and the process of democracy and the role that they played in it. And I think that that's what we have to understand. We have to understand what's at stake when it comes to being able to be in relationship with each other, even you know, with our differences, and even with our deeply held convictions. And remaining in relationship doesn't mean a sacrifice to our principles of justice or what's right.
Well, and picking up on that, Abby, I mean, I do think sometimes this idea of civil discourse gets a bad reputation. People think it's boring and people just being nice and, you know, being just sort of so open to the other person that you don't really hold your own positions in conversation. Help us understand what civil discourse, civil conversation is really all about.
Thank you. And I think that Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Antonin Scalia are beautiful models of this. There's nothing short of wide divides between their worldviews and their positions, but the ability to share them in a way that's respectful. We say that people in civil dialogue. Just want to speak authentically and listen respectfully. And the listening part often gets a short shrift.
Well, listening is hard.
Yes. But we have a genuine, if we have a stance of our best hopes for really understanding someone and really leaning into a relationship and investing in the relationship, then we are curious about their story. And the more that we genuinely show curiosity, I think the less loud people feel they need to speak because they're being heard.
And Lucas, Abby used the word curiosity and listening. Help us understand how those two things go together.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, both are, I mean, if you will, habits that we have to cultivate in us and in each other, and that we have to, practice. I think that, curiosity is something that we all enjoy to be on the other experience of. I think that when we engage each other with an openness and a desire to really deeply understand where we're coming from and each other's fears or and concerns, and when we begin with the assumption that people's convictions are not coming from nowhere, but rather coming from their own life experiences, and when we're genuinely open to learning what those are, then it puts us in a better position to actually engage in conversation.
Because I often think, as not just doing a radio show, but also just being a human being, listening to other people, we often listen because we want to respond. We don't necessarily listen, Lucas, because we actually want to understand.
Right, right. And that, I think that is something that we've got to do better with. I think I think there's a certain way in which we have maybe exacerbated our cultural tensions by, I think, encouraging a lot of speaking, a lot of like stating positions and being vested in where we are rather than really moving into a space of curiosity and learning, and really learning to be hospitable to the encounter of another person and where they are in their life experiences. And I think that's really something that we have to do better at as a country.
Well, picking up on that, Abby, I mean, how do you turn off those judgments?
That's beautiful, Lucas. That's the basis of really being curious, is having that. And it takes practice. It's really hard. It's really hard in these times where we feel so vested in our positions and in the great, really critical questions of the times. I mean, these are serious issues. But I think if we can just try to be, we say, as you know, Marty, that you're the master at good questions, right? If we really have genuine, curious questions about one another, and we pause to really hope to really understand the pain behind somebody's position or the story, the life experience, as Lucas says, I think we're going to have a meaningful conversation. And I think that's the brilliance of what we found of Krista Tippett and On Being Civil Conversations Project, is that it gives us an opportunity to have deeper conversations on a topic. And before we know it, we see we're not debating it, but we're really understanding the nuances behind the vast social issues before us.
I mean, Lucas, this is a sort of technical question, but literally, how do you turn off judgments? I think that's really hard. How do you listen without all that noise in your head?
Yeah, I think that it's important, one, to get in touch with where that judgment is coming from. And a lot of time that it represents fears that we have that are sometimes legitimate and sometimes perceived. And I think that one of the things that we have to do is ask ourselves whether or not we're willing to be vulnerable. I'm careful to say that because we're not all always positioned, and not every conversation is a one where we can feel like we can be vulnerable. But there are a great number of us who can risk a bit more vulnerability than we're in the practice of doing. And in doing that, I think that when we're asking ourselves, okay, what is this fear that we're dealing with, or what is this, where's this judgment coming from, and why is it so deeply held? And when we do that internal work, I think it helps us show up differently in front of the other person. And the technicalities of how we do that really just come from, I think, asking ourselves more critical questions about what's happening within us when we're making these judgments.
Well, I mean, I think that's such an important point, which is, listening to our own perhaps biases or experiences or belief systems that perhaps we haven't questioned the way we might be questioning someone else that we're having a discussion with, Lucas.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that sometimes, you know, those judgments are really a reflection of our misconceptions, and they're also a reflection of things that we don't know. And so I encourage people to, you know, if the question is rooted in a judgment, if our reactions are rooted in the judgment, then maybe we find the question to at least to confirm whether or not our bias is accurate, right? If we think that someone holds a certain view, instead of coming towards them with the presumption that that view is theirs, why don't we ask them?
What an interesting and kind of simple idea. Right, exactly. Abby, let me just read a couple of responses we got to some questions that we tweeted out. The first one being, how do you talk to people you disagree with? Britt says, I listen first. Sounds like what you both are supporting. Ravi says, I don't talk to them. Sherry says, either avoid the topic or try to find some common ground to start with. Abby, you want to respond to either what Lucas was just saying or to what some of our Twitter response people were saying?
Sure. Lucas, I think what Lucas said about asking is just so basic. Right. And just something simple as say more about that, you know, to really, and first of all, we often think that we're going to resolve something in one conversation. And that's, we're really talking about the work that Interfaith Philadelphia does, and is really to put people in relationship and to look at the relationships around us and to invest in those relationships. So we would say open dialogue, open questions, you know, don't be afraid and to really try, especially we had over 500 people come to us through the year of civil conversations for training in facilitating these. And people found that they need these in their own lives, in our own circles. They're not far away from us. So so all that myth about don't talk about politics or religion, we like to burst that. Just, it's really, you know, not difficult. I mean, that's what I think the On Being Project has shown us, is that it's really about taking a step, risking, and really, we do learn about ourselves as we learn about others.
Indeed. Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Abby Stammelman-Hockey, and she's Executive Director of Interfaith Philadelphia. Also with us, Lucas Johnson, Executive Director of On Being Civil Conversations and Social Healing Project. We are talking about how to have a civil conversation when things feel so fraught. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with our guests, Abby Stammelman-Hockey and Lucas Johnson. We're talking about the fact that we're living through a lot of tough stuff, including the pandemic and protests, a bruising election season. There are a lot of raw feelings out there. We're talking about how to navigate fraught topics with people we disagree with, how to have a civil conversation, how to learn about ourselves and perhaps other people, foster greater understanding of each other, and frankly, the world that we share together. Big topics, big questions here. Here's an email from Rebecca, and obviously this political season and the fact that there are such intense feelings about the various candidates and the issues. Here's an email from Rebecca. I wish I felt like I could engage with someone who is, for example, a Trump supporter, but given what I know about his beliefs, I feel that if you support him at this point, you really don't want me and my family, LGBTQ and Muslim, Black, and immigrant, to exist. How do I engage with that? Such an important question. And Lucas, let me begin with you. What do you say back to Rebecca?
Well, I would say that the first question, or the first thing to do is is begin in conversations with people that are close to you that you may assume are all the same views, but I think that these are that engagement is something that is worth practicing. The second thing is when it comes to engaging with Trump supporters, I completely understand where she's coming from in terms of her concern about what these folks feel about her and her communities. I would say that going back to what I was saying before, the positions that people are holding are motivated by a lot of different experiences, and I think that engaging folks and asking them and being vulnerable and saying, you know, this is how what you're saying is making me feel. Like, so how is it true that you don't want me to exist? Is it true that you don't want my communities to exist? Is this, you know, I think that there's some assumptions in her email about Trump supporters that that deserve to be tested, and deserve to give people the opportunity to respond and to show up as different than what she's fearing them to be. And I think that that's what this is about in terms of engaging each other and encountering each other in new ways.
Abby, I'm thinking of the kinds of questions that are helpful to understanding another person. And I've always felt like the question, what are you afraid of? That is, assuming people will be honest, and you have to be kind of vulnerable to be able to both ask and answer that question. But I think that can reveal a lot about a person.
That's true. And just to speak to Rebecca for a moment, I think that's the hardest question that we got during the whole course of time, and we continue to do this work. And first of all, we have to protect ourselves. Nobody should be in a conversation with somebody where they're going to feel injured or wounded. That's not appropriate. So we don't have to put ourselves on the line in that regard. That's what allies are for. You know, perhaps we know people who know those, you know, that the people that Rebecca's thinking to reach out to. And I think it's true. You know, one of my colleagues, right after the 2016 election, decided that she needed to be in conversation with someone who voted for Donald Trump because she really needed to understand this. And she posted, it was a beautiful story. She posted something in the mailroom of her apartment building and said she was seeking to have a conversation with someone who voted for Donald Trump. And indeed, someone, a neighbor, you know, in the apartment building took her up on it, and they had coffee for quite a number of weeks and months. And, you know, that's courageous. But, it, you know, again, it was out of that genuine desire to understand, you know, what is driving your decisions, the question you ask, what are you afraid of? She wasn't the person at risk of being injured by that conversation.
Sure. And that's an important difference. Here's a related email. One from Tony says, when we listen and we hear that someone is hateful or racist, should we be tolerant of their beliefs? What's the limit of tolerance? Lucas, let me toss that back to you.
So first, let me just echo what Abby just said in terms of the people's different locations to any different subject or situation. And no, I don't think that we have to be tolerant to people's racist points of view, and we don't have to subject ourselves to harm. I don't think that showing up and being curious and asking questions and engaging means inherently that we're condoning someone's viewpoints that are that are harmful. I think that one of the things that it's important for us to remember is that we were all once ignorant about a great number of issues of justice or social concern to many things. And I think that if we can engage each other from a perspective of humility, from our own awareness of how possible it is, and how disoriented things can be in the world with all of the misinformation and things that are out there, then I think that helps us have a disposition of generosity towards each other. But no, I don't think that engaging someone means condoning a racist or violent point of view.
Let me toss something else out there, and I'll give you a chance, Abby, to respond. And then I do want to read some more questions that we put out on Twitter. I've interviewed a number of former skinheads, former, frankly, white supremacists. And you don't want to make broad generalizations, but there were moments in their particular lives where someone was either kind to them or spoke to the kinds of painful feelings that they had about their lives that somehow got them to see that being a skinhead or a white supremacist was not the person that they wanted to be. Now, maybe it was just the right time, asking the right question, but it seems it was interesting. I mean, it's a story I've heard more than once. Now, of course, these are people that decided, I'm not going to live this life anymore. But nonetheless, is there something we can learn from that?
There's a lot to be learned from that. The famous story that we go back to is the story of Derek Black, David Duke's godson, and his encounter on the university campus with a Jewish student, Matthew Stevenson. And there's a beautiful interview by Krista Tippett with them, which is really illustrative because we, on the face of it, and I agree with Lucas, having a conversation does not condone a view. And the brilliance of the relationship established once Derek Black was outed on campus as being a white nationalist was that his friends, some of whom were Jewish, began to invite him to Shabbat dinners. And the ground rule was, we're not going to talk about this or debate it, but we're going to stay in relationship. And over time, those relationships led to a sense of a bit of a human touch and warm touch that led Derek Black to conversations that opened his ears and eyes to other things. So these things take time, and it's worth being in relationship. We're on earth together. We're here in a world to solve problems together.
I mean, the importance of human connection for all of us.
Yeah.
Marty,
go ahead, Lucas. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, sometimes I think one of the things that we have to realize is that we exist in relationship to each other. And so really the choice is only whether or not we're in good relationship or bad relationship. I mean, we can pretend like each other don't exist, but the process, the reality of democracy, the reality of us sharing space means that we have to figure this out somehow. And I think that's, we sometimes... We imagine that we might be able to separate ourselves and isolate ourselves. That is contrary to reality. It's certainly contrary to epidemiology as we see, right? Mm-hmm. And so we have to figure out what it means for us to be in a different kind of relationship to each other. And I think that's what this is about. And it's not simply, I think that we have to reorient ourselves to that reality in order for us to decide how we should engage and whether we should engage.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Lucas Johnson, Executive Director of On Being Civil Conversations and Social Healing Project. Also with us, Abby Stammelman-Hockey. She's Executive Director of Interfaith Philadelphia. Also serves as a member of NewCore. That's the New Conversation on Race and Ethnicity. And we are talking about how to have a civil conversation in what often feels like very uncivil times. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us, again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. And we did tweet out a series of questions over the course of this week. One was, have you stopped talking to people because of differing opinions? Kate said, stop talking about certain subjects, yes, but not stop talking altogether. Andrew, yeah, it's important to stand up for what you believe in. Some rifts are too wide to jump. Sherry said, I try to avoid difficult topics in order to keep the peace, but yes, I've let some people go when there wasn't much worth saving in the relationship. Jay said yes, but stop talking about only certain things to avoid arguing. So to you, Abby, I see our listeners, people responding to our Twitter question, trying to sort of straddle, hold on to the relationship, but decide, certain topics are just going to be off topic for us in order to keep this relationship going.
Yeah, that's interesting because I think that's what we found in all of those that we worked with in the last years is people don't want to sever relationships, and staying in the relationship, as Lucas said, and being in relationship is probably the most important thing. We don't have to go to the most difficult topics, but I think continuing to show respect for one another and for the dignity of one another is ultimately the most important. We can't sever our relationships in these times. We need one another.
And Lucas, I often think that, you know, words matter, but I think tone matters almost as much as the words that we use, like how we use those words gets received, I think, sometimes more than even the words themselves. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think that we have to remember that a big part of being in conversation is making sure that we're engaging in a way that that both we're understood and our intentions are understood, and that in any given conversation there are many layers of how we're communicating, and tone is certainly one of those. But we also have to be able to be hospitable to another person's pain, mm-hmm. and anger and frustration. And so it works both ways. On one hand, we have to communicate in ways that, that, you know, accurately represent what we're feeling, and try to communicate in ways that can be well received. But on the other hand, we have to be hospitable to people showing up however they need to show up. In a conversation.
Let me read another comment. This is Rick. Many times when we encounter someone, there will be a prejudgment and we go for feelings instead of facts. If we really enjoy the friendship, we need to get to the facts and find common ground. We might be surprised by what we find. I wonder to you, Abby, how important facts are. And we know that you know, a lot of us live in different factual worlds and get our information from really different sources and don't even share sort of common facts. How important do you think are facts and agreeing on facts to a civil conversation?
I appreciate Rick raising it that way. In our work, we draw on some of the compassionate listening projects exercises, and we ask people to tell a challenging story about an encounter with someone they're trying to build a bridge with. And we ask people to sit in a group, and somebody listens for the facts, somebody listens for the feelings, and somebody listens for the values. Hmm. And then we reflect this back. And the exercise, I would encourage one another to do this, it's we realize after that how many things are happening in a conversation that we're to attend to. And we look at, this is one of the ways we dig back about the earlier questions about what are our triggers and how do we set aside our judgments. We quickly realize what our proclivity is, that we really don't listen for facts, or we debate facts, but we don't listen for feelings or the values behind. But what we find is, ultimately, we want to get to the values, and that's where we can find common ground. And there are shared values in our vastly different worldviews.
Such as what values do you think that people have in common in spite of all their differences?
I once heard in one of our youth programs, we had a young Jewish boy and a young Muslim girl talk about the topic that they disagreed on about gay marriage. And they each told a story about why they cared about this topic. And then everyone in the room needed to list the values that they heard in the stories that they told. And so there was values of family, values of love, values of relationship, and values of faith in both of those stories, for example. And then the two of them sat and talked and moved forward in a conversation, as did those participating.
Which raises an interesting question, Lucas, about just the value importance of storytelling, of telling something about your life in the midst of a conversation about, let's say, even an abstract issue or idea.
Yeah, I think it goes back to what we were saying earlier about curiosity. I think that we oftentimes want to show up and we want to bend another viewpoint to our sort of abstract perception of what's right. But really, what's right is rooted in part in our sense of who we are, and as long as we engage in a conversation from that vantage point without telling the story of who we are, which includes a story of our values, then we won't be able to make much progress on that principle of what's right.
Another question we tossed out there, is social media an effective way to have civil dialogue? Lucas, can I put that back to you? We have about a minute before our second break here. Is that a good place to have some of these conversations?
Oh, it's a challenging place to have some of these conversations. but it is a place where many of us are and live, or spend a lot of our time, rather. And I think that engaging in social media has to be done delicately. And I think that it's easy for people to engage each other in social media as though there is no relationship there.
Right.
And I think that what we have to do is sort of project ourselves, and we have to engage as though that person is as human as we are, and sort of shift our minds to not think of that person as sort of some abstraction, but an actual human being. And because I think we engage with each other differently face to face than we would in social media. Yeah. And so I think that's one of the things that we have to keep in mind.
Yeah, I think no question about that. And when you're anonymous, you know, you can feel emboldened to say almost anything. Well, we are talking about how to talk civilly to each other and understand another person's point of view, especially when you disagree. That's Lucas Johnson, Executive Director of On Being Civil Conversations and Social Healing Project. Abby Stammelman Kahaki is Executive Director of Interfaith Philadelphia, also a member of NewCore, which stands for the New Conversation on Race and Ethnicity. You can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this short break. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Looking for answers or ways of discussing some of these questions. How do we reach across all the divides that keep us apart, make us strangers to each other? How do we have difficult conversations with people we disagree with that don't devolve into shouting matches? How do we listen without judgment? Can civil dialogue make a difference in our lives and our larger community, maybe even the nation? And we're talking with Abby Stammelman Hockey and Lucas Johnson. And with you, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read an email that was sent from one of our listeners in Kensington. It says, I'm a white male who was discussing via text with a white female friend the long-term political effectiveness of the Black Lives Matter movement. I said that sadly, the Black Lives Matter movement has been losing support from white people, and it suggested that it might be due to news about all the looting and violence associated with it. She says that's not true, and ranted at me in all caps about how blacks are not treated well in our country, which I agree with. Then my friend said, I sound racist. I suggested she calm down, which made things only worse. He asks, how can inconvenient facts be discussed with people whose passionate beliefs impair their rational thinking? It's a loaded question, Abby. You've got emotion, you've got facts as one person sees them, and you've got a disagreement over a very important and divisive issue.
Mm. Well, thank you for being so disclosive. Our emailer from Kensington.
Yeah.
These are very real conversations, and if they're not happening openly, they're certainly happening behind closed doors. So, you know, these are times. Wish we weren't in a pandemic that really call for a nice cup of coffee, right? To kind of, you defined yourselves as friends. I love that. And we have, and so it's an opportunity, you know, is there an opportunity to ask why is there looting? What does looting have to do with the injustice, you know, in our country that's being exposed? So, you know, there are conversations to be had if there's a willingness on both sides. And I think there's a curiousness, hopefully, to understand what is feeling threatening, you know, about the Black Lives Matter movement, or to really try to transcend and to try to explain what is the uprising about, you know, the justice denied is justice delayed. The summer of riots, as Martin Luther King said, led to the summers of riots. You know, I want to understand this better, mm-hmm. and I hope, you know, I have to understand it better as a citizen of our country. I have to. So if there's a friendship, this is a perfect opportunity. Right. Thank you for writing.
Yeah, I mean, the friendship is I guess, the key thing. I wonder, too, Lucas, I mean, we talk about having disagreements with people, but there is another issue of just avoiding topics or even avoiding people altogether. What's the price of that?
Well, I mean, I think, if I may just comment on the last writer's
sure.
Email, I think one thing that's also important for us to remember is that when you're dealing with topics that are so painful and so difficult, it's always good to first, particularly when you're talking to someone who is affected by whatever's happening, it's always good to first make sure that other person feels heard and seen and acknowledged in their pain. And part of what it seems like may have been happening in that exchange is that, you know, one person may not have seen or acknowledged the position of you know, anguish or pain or frustration or grief that the other was feeling. And so offering a fact before doing that work of showing up in a way that makes someone understand what's at stake for them, or their perception of what's at stake for all of us, can often go awry. And so I think that's something that's important to remember. Marty, I've now forgotten your question.
You know, I knew you were going to say that, and I totally forgot my question as well. Perhaps our listeners can tell me what I was asking you, Lucas, but let me go on from there. I knew you were going to say that. Another question we tweeted out, have you ever had your mind changed or changed someone's mind about an important issue? Andrew said, yeah, but it doesn't usually happen with an argument or a conversation, though it takes more time. Sherry, yes, but it takes time, a mutual respect, and a willingness to listen. I mean, is the goal, do you think, Abby, like changing someone's mind, or is it understanding where they come from?
Yes, that's a perfect question. We really came to believe that many people why did people come to Interfaith Philadelphia to learn about civil conversations? And we came to hear from people that being in relationship across religious traditions, you know, is the perfect example of having respect for one another and one another's worldviews and differences and distinctiveness, and respecting that while not trying to convert one another, right? I mean, that's the bottom line. We're not in relationship if we're there to convert. So in conversation as well, what is our hope? If our hope is to change somebody's mind, then we are in a position of debating. We're not in a position of really trying to understand one another's viewpoints and to understand the context and to solve problems together and to work together with views that we may see something that others do not. So I think that's the big difference. We try, you know, we hope that one another will respect a viewpoint, mm-hmm. That's not the purpose always. Doesn't have to always be the purpose.
And Lucas, I think, it's hard to live with difference, right? I mean, it's hard to live with and maybe love or care about someone when you see things so differently.
It is. And I think that's where we have to, you know, it goes back to something that Abby had said earlier. That's where we have to go back to the values and the common values. And we find that the road that we can walk together along those shared values is quite far in terms of, you know, what it means for us to live in a functioning, healthy democracy together. I don't want to act as though or to create a false equivalence between, you know, moral positions. I don't think that this is about doing that. It's okay to hold those differing views and to be in relationship while debating them vigorously. And it's okay to hope that another person comes to a different point of view about some things. I think that's different than the interfaith context that that Abby was describing to some extent. And but I think that what we have to find is a sort of common framework for being in relationship with one another, and a way that we can do that respectfully.
Here's a comment from Mary. I'll put this to you, Abby. She says, what I've been noticing is a rise in narcissism and a lack of empathy in society. How do you engage someone with empathy if they don't also value empathy? Do you agree with her assessment?
That it's a generalization.
Yeah.
We will encounter people in our lives and in our country, you know, who lack empathy, but you know, and it's the million-dollar question, you know, is this personality trait, is this life experience? You know, we again, we're not, I liked what Lucas said, we're not to be in relationship with one another if it's putting us in harm's way. But if this is an important person in your life, Mary, and if you show empathy, if we show compassion, hopefully that will be, you know, rise above and begin to soften, you know, that person's understanding.
Do you agree with that, Lucas, that if we show a true empathy, that we can get at least a piece of empathy in response?
I think often, I like Abby said, this is a generalization, but I think that we often can, and I think that it's something that we're very well practiced at suppressing our empathy, you know, in the country, and so I don't want to pretend like it's easy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we often, you know, a lot of times, in order for us to function in society, it seems as though we have to suppress our empathy towards the person who's living on the streets who needs money, or to suppress our empathy towards any number of situations. So we're well practiced at trying to sort of move past what we may be feeling inside of ourselves. But I think that what we have to do is create the opportunities to slow down and really be present to and with one another. And I think that is something that's necessary for, you know, the healing of the country in many ways. So I think it is possible.
Let me just be a little personal here. And Abby, I'll put this to you. And both of you talked about stories and thinking about sort of how we grew up. My husband grew up in a house that, frankly, had a lot of conflict and arguments. He said it was okay for me to say that on the air. I grew up in a house that was really conflict averse. I did not know how to argue. My parents divorced, but I never saw them fight. So there was this kind of mysterious world about how to be in conflict with someone without losing the relationship. And I think that's probably both things that we've had to struggle with as adults as well. But how important is it, Abby, to understand our childhood and the kind of messages that we grew up with and the kind of families that we grew up in?
Very, very important. And thank you for your sharing that story, because that's so true that often, and that's part of why having some humility and trying to understand someone's story, where their feelings come from, will help us better engage in conversation, because we can have empathy for that. And when we do work where we ask people who come to us to try to facilitate, to learn to lead and facilitate civil conversations, we do that personal work first. We ask people to look back at experiences and their own triggers. And we often say, you know, if you're going to have a difficult conversation, perhaps you do it, you co-lead a conversation. So because something that's hard for you will not be hard for me. It is extremely important to know ourselves and to understand that everyone had different experiences growing up around conflict. Thank you for saying that.
Oh, absolutely. Here's an email from Bruce. I'll put this to you, Lucas. He says, doesn't there come a time when one just has to give up? I have a very good friend who, when it comes to politics, we cannot talk. So we have completely given up speaking about the news. And maybe that is to preserve the relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly possible. And I think it's important to say that it's, you know, we're not all equally positioned to have every conversation. And we can't have every conversation at every point of time. And so, I think that it's certainly the case that, you know, people may just feel like this is not, you know, this is not something that they can talk about in the context of that relationship. But maybe that's just for now.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there will be a time when it'll be easier. What I worry about and what I don't want is for people to shy away from the difficult conversations that we need to have in the country in order to move forward on things. And I think that so on one hand, I want to acknowledge that people do need to think about their own, safety, and they need to be concerned about what that means. But then on the other hand, I want to encourage some people in some relationships to have the hard questions that they may avoid. I think that that's also important for us to function in our democracy.
Abby, another question we tweeted out, how do you hold your ground while remaining civil? Do you have some thoughts about that?
We can only be ourselves. You know, I think as long as we're, authentic, I mean, holding ground means, again, that sounds like a something more positioned for a debate. You know, I hope to go into conversations where I'm able to be myself and share my passionate feelings authentically, but I'm there also to listen and to go deeper. I think what you gave the example of earlier, Marty, is important. Maybe we need to model these conversations in our family dinner table, you know. and I think in this day and age, we can, bemoan some of the bad sides of social media. But seriously, I mean, podcasts, your radio show, are opportunities to bring to the dinner table sophisticated and nuanced conversations around topics so people know there's an alternative way to talk about things. It's not just black and white.
Here's what Aaron said in response to that question. I think the biggest thing for me is knowing where I stand. Having my views challenged forces me to find good information to back me up, and the confidence that comes from that goes a long way. Lucas, we're almost out of time, but what do you think about Aaron's response to that?
I think it's good to know where you stand, and in some sense, and I think it's also good to keep asking important questions around the issues that we care about and about the things that we believe in. I think asking the questions and being around people that are asking questions, not from a perspective of trying to get you in some way, trying to catch you in an error of belief, or I think we sometimes go along as though we need to have a position paper that on every given subject, and that position paper needs to be solid, and that's the way we engage each other. I think sometimes we can change that positioning to say, hey, we both care about this problem. We may have a different idea of how to solve it, but let's change that positioning. Instead of us being on either side of the issue coming towards each other, let's get on the same side and try to address it together.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Lucas Johnson, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. It was an honor.
It was a pleasure to have you on. And he is executive director of On Being Civil Conversations and Social Healing Project. Abby Stammelman-Hockey, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she is executive director of Interfaith Philadelphia. Today's episode was done in collaboration with Dr. Frank Lee at Drexel University on his Knight Foundation-funded project, Civil Dialogue, and it's part of Philadelphia Tech Week or Philly Tech Week. Thank you for responding to our Twitter questions throughout the week. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.